Dr. R.J. Rushdoony, RR151B3, Intellectual Schizophrenia, Q&A, Christian Schools.
Now for our concluding speaker that has spoken twice already today and has certainly blessed our heart, Dr. R.J. Rushdoony, speaking on intellectual schizophrenia. Dr. Rushdoony.
There is an old story about a university professor who had a nightmare in which he dreamed that he was lecturing to his class and woke up and found that he was. I'm reminded of that story because I slept only about an hour and a quarter last night on a plane from Los Angeles to Memphis. And I hope the same doesn't befall either myself or you. Our subject now is intellectual schizophrenia. In particular, the schizophrenia that besets the advocates of public education. We shall in this hour deal with the liberal and radical critique of the public schools. In recent years, there has been a growing critique of the schools, a growing dissatisfaction with them. And this is, in one respect, not surprising. One of the things that catches my eye when I go on campus, and I do appear on many secular university campuses, year in and year out, is to examine the lecture subjects of other speakers, of secular humanistic speakers. Basically, there is quite a polarity in these subjects, and they can be summed up under two heads. One type of speech is, will man survive? And the implication is that he won't. And the other type of speech is the coming triumph of world socialism. There's something schizophrenic here. A very wild ambivalence between hopelessness and wild confidence. We should not be surprised at this. Because in humanism, all depends on man, and man is God. Man will, as he faces the immensity of his task and realizes that he faces it alone, be sometimes desperately, totally hopeless. On the other hand, as he tells himself that he is the only God in the universe, he begins to feel that he is omnipotent and that if he says a thing shall come to pass, and passes a law to that effect, it should. After all, when man thinks of himself as God, he thinks in terms of those categories of thought which are inescapable with a concept of the Godhead. And one is the creative word. And God said, and it was so. And today in our schools and in our legislative assemblies, these men who see themselves as gods try the same thing. They pass a law, and reality should be changed, but it is not. They institute an educational program which should bring about a new kind of person, and it does not. When man plays God against the void of a meaningless world, he does become schizophrenic. And so it is, too, that as he faces schools, he does so with wild confidence and bitter despair. There have been a flood of books in the last two or three years by radicals and liberals attacking the government schools. I could go into some of the more radical critiques. The Santa Barbara Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions has a number of publications and writers attacking the whole concept of statist education from a far leftist position, attacking the idea of a compulsory school law, and a great deal more. Dr. Illich is notable among those who have mounted such an attack. But let us take a more moderate leftist attack, such as that by Colin Greer. Colin Greer's book, The Great School Legend, A Revisionist Interpretation of American Public Education, cites a fact that does concern many of these critics of statist education. They realize that 9 million current school children will enter the labor market as functional illiterates. This is their own admission. 9 million children across the United States will finish their schooling as functional illiterates. This certainly does not spell success. Moreover, as Colin Greer points out, it is very difficult to call these facts to the attention of the educational fraternity and segments of the public because, he says, and I quote, public education is a religion, unquote. The modern faith is in salvation by education. The goal in our schools, he says, has radically changed from the colonial period when the function of schools was to produce the Christian man, fully armed and prepared by means of education to meet all problems. Then it became Americanization. And Americanization progressively became socialistically interpreted, not sufficiently to suit, of course, Colin Greer and others. But he says the schools have failed to Americanize. Immigrants are not educated properly. They have become largely able to progress in the United States by self-education. Now, Greer is correct at this point. A very large body of studies over the past few years has revealed the fact that instead of being the great Americanizing force, the schools were a very divisive and repressive force. They did not Americanize the Germans or the Irish or the Italians or any other group that came to this country. Nor were they very helpful in teaching them even English. I included the Irish there, by the way, because the great Irish immigration from 1820 on was largely not English-speaking. They were the Gaelic-speaking Irish. In fact, so many of the Gaelic-speaking rural Irish came over that Ireland has virtually no Gaelic-speaking people left. The Irish immigrants then had to learn English also. Who taught them? Predominantly, with all these immigrant groups, the basic education was done by their churches and by their own nationalistic organizations, the German-American group, the Italian-American group, the Irish-American group, and so on. The documentation for this is quite extensive. The schools did not help them. They were misfits in the schools, and they were treated as the lowest of the low. They were very quickly weeded out. As a result, there was an inner development in the ghetto areas of the big cities in which the organizations within the society, Italian or Irish or German or what have you, trained their own people and enabled them to advance and to improve their lot in this country. But there is a far more radical critique that Colin Greer makes of statist education. It is a startling one coming from a person who is himself totally non-Christian. He never even considers the Christian perspective. The schools, he says, have been radically ugly and evil in their basic impact because of their Darwinism. Now, this is a startling criticism coming from a man who never even considers Christianity as a live option. He says the theory of natural selection, which lies behind much of the American popular faith in public education, this theory consistently ignores the reality and effectiveness of the criteria imposed from above upon those attempting to climb the ladder of success. And then he goes on to develop primarily what he means by this. The theory of natural selection, survival of the fittest. In education, he says, this means that the public schools, the government schools, very early in the last century, shortly after Darwin, began to imbibe this perspective. In other words, they imbibed it almost within a couple of decades after the public schools were established. What did they do? They began to weed out, in terms of the doctrine of natural selection, the survival of the fittest, those who are not the elite. And so, he said, the policy until approximately 1930 was weed out the lower levels in grade school. The high school will be the training ground and the college for the elite, those who will provide the leadership for our Darwinian society. They shall be trained for education, for leadership in state, in commerce, and in social life. The rest for the labor market as unskilled or semi-skilled workers. But Greer points out, beginning in the 20s, there began to be a problem of unemployment. This presented a problem. Turn out all these youth at 12, 13, 14, when there was no way of absorbing them into society. This might, they felt, create a revolutionary situation. And so the educational policy became, let us raise the mandatory school age to 16 or 18 and hold them in school longer. And especially with the Depression, this became the general practice. Hold them in school longer. Keep them off the labor market. We cannot absorb them. Therefore, do not flunk them out in grade school or in high school. And increasingly, educational philosophy posited a mandatory passing all through the lower grades. And passing became increasingly the order of the day. Even those schools that did flunked with the idea of helping the student to get ahead the next semester so that he could see his way through high school as a high school graduate. The flunking, you see, was then to be done on the college level. Since World War II, the situation has altered increasingly. Because as we have a less and less free society and more a socialistic society, jobs become, as a result, progressively more and more a problem. As a result, The idea increasingly is hold them in school until approximately 20 with a junior college system, and pass them all the way through the second year of college. No flunking. And in state after state, California is one of these, this is becoming the routine thing. Every child must go through school to the age of 18 and is increasingly guided and steered through junior college. So it is becoming normal for all, virtually without exception, to continue in their schooling to the age of 20. No failure below that. In college, the weeding is 40% or more, depending upon the school. It should be higher, some hold, but increasingly the attitude is, perhaps as our economic situation becomes more and more difficult, we should hold them all the way through college and flunk them out in graduate school. State colleges are increasingly established with this in mind. Let them through. Let's hold them as long as possible. We are less likely then to have social revolution. As a result, very grave problems confront schools on all levels today, both because this Darwinism leads to a feeling that they are training an elite only, they are preparing leadership, and also because most students are aware of the fact that they are being babysat, that they are going to be passed, that nothing much is expected of them, that they are simply cogs in a machine. The first student revolt, which broke out at the Berkeley campus of the University of California, very definitely was motivated by this impulse. The motto of the revolting students was, "Do not fold, mutilate, or staple." In other words, their feeling was, "We are not persons. We are merely things that are being pushed along as useless until they can no longer push us any further in the educational process. And we resent being treated as something in the giant computer without any human significance." Colin Greer is right. Education no longer is as it was in the colonial period and the first half century of the Republic. The education of the Christian man. Every child to be educated in terms of the faith, in terms of the covenant, in terms of a responsibility under God to be a whole man in Jesus Christ. Now it is Darwinism. Weed out the culls, prepare a handful for social, political, and industrial leadership. It is a ruthless, heartless system. Moreover, faith is gone in that system, faith in anything. Dr. Nesbitt, one of the finest sociologists in the world today, has written a study, and it delighted me because I was writing something along the same lines at the same time, although he did a far profounder job as far as the historical side was concerned, while mine was more theological. He titled his little study, The End of the University, I believe, or the Decline and Collapse, or Decline and Fall of the University. His thesis was that the university was the last medieval institution, and that as such, it was now going. My thesis, of course, was very much along the same line, approaching it from a different perspective. I singled out the term by Dr. Clark Kerr, who in the early 1960s declared that the university was gone, that the multiversity had taken its place. Now his point in choosing this term was simply this. A university is a Christian concept. It presupposes that there is one God, one world of law, one universe, and therefore a university in which this unified body of truth and law is taught. It's a theistic concept. It is thoroughly a biblical concept. But today, there is no concept of absolute truth, and the modern higher educational institution believes in a multiverse. There can be many systems that have evolved out of the primordial atom. There are therefore perhaps many universes. It is a multiverse, and therefore the university is no longer tenable. It must be a multiversity in which anything goes except Christianity, which holds to a one world of truth, absolute truth and law. As a result, today we do have multiversities, and the multiversities are militantly hostile to Christianity. But having no absolutes, they teach magic. They teach almost any and every subject under the sun, including astrology. They have no truth. And so it is that one of the most distinguished scientists of our time, a man who has no trace of Christianity in him, has written a very telling book on the end of the Golden Age. This man, a molecular biologist at the University of California, has analyzed what is happening to the university. And he declares that without the concept of truth, it is no longer possible to have science. Science will disappear. And he says that increasingly in graduate students, this fact is becoming apparent. The graduate student no longer is like the scholar of old with a passion for truth. He's there because he is an antiquarian, just as some people collect stamps because it appeals to them. So he is interested in physics or chemistry because he's doing his thing. And so he says, this kind of interest will wane. It will mean that science will disappear. In a couple of centuries, man having reverted to barbarism because he has no belief in truth, nor any desire to learn, will disappear from the face of the earth. In the spring of 1970, when Natural History reviewed the book, it was given 4 pages of review, and the reviewer concluded that he could not buy the author's optimism. Modern education is bankrupt. This bankruptcy came to very clear focus in a very startling report, which was published in 1966. It had been commissioned earlier by President Kennedy, and Dr. James S. Coleman of Johns Hopkins University had been made chairman of the commission. It was the Equality of Educational Opportunity Report. It was a study with the use of computers of all schools in the United States. Since there was a great concern over integration, it was a study of the schools as they differed, what was the difference between the black schools and the white schools, and so on. Every aspect. The report was a major shock, both to the committee as the data began to come in, and also to educators and politicians, and they have ignored it. About the only attention paid to it was by Harvard University, which appointed a faculty seminar on the Coleman Report on Equality of Educational Opportunity, edited by Frederick Mosler and Daniel P. Moynihan, analyzing the significance of it and, in effect, saying, yes, this is so. We see no holes in this report. It's valid. It was very interesting, too, that the report did not deal with Christian schools at all. There was one sentence that indicated something of a recognition of their existence. This sentence says, no one yet knows how to make a ghetto school work. Perhaps it should be said, no one knows how to make a public ghetto school work. Now, the findings of the EEOR, or the Coleman Report, whose years cover the era just before the compulsory integration of schools, in essence, came to three conclusions. The first, which startled everyone, was this: black and white schools are virtually equal in quality. This was a shocker. There were slight differences. On some points, the white schools had an advantage over the black schools, but at other points, the black schools had an advantage over the white schools. So that as far as equality of educational opportunity was concerned, segregation had not handicapped the blacks. The second conclusion was even more upsetting to the educational fraternity. It was that money makes no difference in educational results. Spend as much as you want on facilities, equipment, plant, and so on, it makes no difference. I trust some of you will remember this when the pressure is on you in your Christian school to have a chemistry lab or a physics lab. Forget it. As a matter of fact, I believe a very strong case could be made for the fact that they are a detriment to education. Those labs are a joke. No student learns to experiment. No experiment is ever conducted in a high school laboratory. They are just demonstrations of experiments that were made generations ago. And that demonstration could be done by a teacher before the entire class much more economically, much more effectively, with better teaching results. As a matter of fact, I was told by one instructor in chemistry that he preferred students from schools where they did not have labs. They had learned more. They had done less playing with the little gadgets in the chemistry lab and more learning. The Coleman Report thus very definitely confirmed the fact that money makes no difference in results. The third result was even more devastating to the educational fraternity, and it was this: the family is basic in educational achievement. The basic problem they found with black students in schools was not that there was not enough money spent upon them, nor that they lacked good teachers. The basic problem was that 55% of the black children only had both parents in the home. The other 45% you could write off educationally. And this was the problem. 85%, or 80% of the whites, had both parents in the home. The other 20% were useless in school. In other words, the family is the governing factor in education. thus far the Coleman Report. But the question it did not face was this: what is meant by the family? It obviously includes heredity. It obviously includes morality. And it very obviously includes religion. The determinative aspect of education is not in education as far as our public schools are concerned. In the Christian school reinforces the family, the basic educational unit, and therefore it is able to accomplish a great deal. The public school does not. Its effect, thus at best, is deleterious, bad. It cannot educate, it basically can only harm, and this it is doing. And ironically, with deliberate intent, statist educational philosophy has leveled its guns at God and the family. In his book, A Common Faith, John Dewey, in 1932, declared that Christianity, biblical Christianity, and democracy were not compatible. Why? Because, he said, the concept of Christianity that we meet with in the Bible is hopelessly aristocratic. It tells us that there is a division between the saved and the lost, the sheep and the goats, between truth and error, heaven and hell. And that's aristocratic, hopelessly so. It is anti-democratic. In 1948, James Bryant Conant, former president of Harvard, former high commissioner of Germany, scientist, began to make surveys of education for the NEA. And he wrote in Education in a Divided World on page 8, published in 1948 by the Harvard University Press, that there was an irreconcilable conflict between democracy and the family. Every family is an aristocratic institution. It wants the best for its children, and it doesn't think about the children of the poor Hottentots or the children in the slum. It gets the best possible clothing, housing, food, and schooling for its children and does not think about the others. And so, he said, there was an inescapable conflict between democracy and the family. They have thus waged war against the only agency that has been able to be of any help to the school. Have they learned anything from the Coleman Report? Well, the fact that the Coleman Report is virtually unknown, and only a few people on the high levels of the educational fraternity are familiar with it, is revealing. What are these people who are familiar with the Coleman Report doing? They are proposing a solution. First, that we begin education at the ages of 3 to 4 years. And undercut the family thereby and increase the power and influence of the school by replacing the family as quickly as possible in the formative years of the child. And second, that we create a central campus in each community, requiring that all children be boarded there in order to nullify and undercut the family. Ironic, is it not? The secular statist educators themselves have come up with these conclusions. And then they go directly against their findings because of their humanistic bent to make no concession to the family, let alone God. Now, it is ironic that they are planning to repeat precisely the error of the Soviet Union. In the 1920s, the Soviets experimented precisely in this field. They provided nurseries for all working mothers and morning-to-night care for all children, and took away the children from families. The parents picked them up at night and took them home. There's a story told that is true of one Soviet mother in those days that stopped by at the nursery late at night to pick up her baby, to go home, and then, of course, to come again in the morning very early before she went again to the factory and work. And as she started out of the door with her baby, she looked and noticed it was not her baby. And she turned and said, "But this is not my child. You've given me the wrong baby." And the woman in attendance said, "But what difference does it make? It's just going to go home and sleep at your place all night, and you're going to bring it back again." And, of course, it was that impersonal. The hard-working mothers could do nothing except put their child to bed while they hurriedly fed the family, went to bed, and in the morning carted it back to the nursery. The results were deadly. Dr. Lebedeva, Soviet head of the Department for the Protection of Motherhood and Infancy, declared when the policy was abandoned, and I quote, "Under present conditions, there is no doubt that the home offers a more stimulating environment for the development of the infant than the asylum. Not only have we decreased the death rate in this way by placing the institutional children in private homes, but we have ensured normal development to a much larger proportion of babies. Since in almost every case our asylum-trained babies were both mentally and physically backwards," unquote. As a matter of fact, and this was still under Stalin, some of the Soviet bureaucracy went so far as to say it was better for the child to be in a family taught by parents who are still Christian all the old superstitions of the Bible than to be in a state nursery, because the state nursery, to use a modern expression, would blow the minds of the child and its body too. And at least they had a potentially useful citizen in the home-trained child. But of course, this doesn't mean the Soviet Union gave up. A friend and associate of mine, when I was at the Foundation, regularly read to the Soviet publications, and he found that there was a great deal of editorializing about the grandmother problem. The grandmothers were the ones who stayed home and took care of the grandchildren, and they were teaching them all those horrible Bible stories. And so what they had hoped to eliminate was being fed to the younger generation. The modern educational community, thus, is beset with intellectual schizophrenia. It is at war with itself and with reality. It recognizes the growing collapse in the area of statist education, but it has no answer to the problem. It recognizes the importance of the family and then works to undermine the family. No more than the Soviet Union, having recognized the centrality of the family, can reestablish the family without faith, can we create any substitute for the family. The Soviet Union has very rigid and puritanical laws in effect now, and yet it is being eaten up with a dry rot of the new morality pornography, and every kind of moral dissipation and degeneracy imaginable. By failing to provide that one thing which makes the family strong, a vital Christian faith, they have so undermined themselves today in the Soviet Union that they have a major problem with production. They can no longer, with promises, get the people to work. Production is collapsing in every area. And this is why there is a tremendous urgency to have consumer goods, particularly automobiles, produced. The invitation to European companies to build their auto plants there, so that they can advertise to their youth, work hard, save your money, you too can be like the youth of America, you can have your own car. Now this is the purpose of the manufacture of automobiles there, to try to bribe the youth to work. The early indications are that it will not be too very successful. There is an inner collapse because of the disappearance of any faith for living. And our statist education today is progressively creating a collapse within a sizable segment of American life. It has no future as a result. As against this, today we have a growing body of youth who are being educated in Christian schools. Now, I grant you that many of these schools are not all that they should be. But enough of them are doing an unparalleled job of educating the youth, so that a leadership is coming forward which will, in not too many years, command this country, remake the churches, and create a new kind of culture. One pastor who has had a Christian school for some few years now has said, "Do you know that I find it easier to preach and to preach more exegetically and systematically, more theologically, in my school chapel than to my Sunday morning congregation, because there is a different kind of character and maturity in them." As we face the future, therefore, we need to recognize that we are living in a dying age and a dying world, and we should rejoice. It deserves to die. But the future belongs to those who are in Christ, and we shall triumph. Of that, there is no question. I think we have time for a few questions, unless you'd like to conclude it now. Are there any questions? Yes.
You made reference to this question earlier, sir, to state education, I think you would say. To me, usually when we say the state, I think in terms of the national state, and here, of course, we have 50 to run education. Doesn't this kind of provide some diversity? Doesn't this ameliorate the situation somewhat? In other words, they don't have here the situation that they would have had in a German where an almighty nation state can say so.
That was the case a decade ago. Today, the federal funds control all the states, far more than the many state superintendents themselves recognize. For example, the textbooks that are produced today are produced on subsidies by the federal government to the publishers and to the writers involved. This is why your new textbooks in the public schools are such beautiful things. There's unlimited funds to spend on. The funds are provided on specification that these textbooks are going to cover a particular subject from a particular point of view, so that you can have a very liberal and a moderately liberal and a slightly conservative type of textbook. Thus, when a state system offers to the schools within the state its choice, say in California as they do, three approved texts in a particular subject, all of those are federally subsidized. On top of that, so many federal funds come into every school district that in effect what you have to say is that increasingly all 50 states are branches of one federal school system. On top of that, you must further say that our universities and colleges are divided between state and federal institutions. The so-called private schools are largely federal. The amount of funds, for example, that Stanford University has that are federal funds is so vast that I know that about 10 years ago, when I wrote Messianic Character, I thought for a while of going into this area of analyzing funds, and I found at that time that a slightly higher percentage of federal funds had gone into Stanford than state funds into the University of California at Berkeley. In other words, there was almost as much in the way of private funds at Berkeley as there was at Stanford. This is why at Stanford or Harvard or any one of these other supposedly private universities, they can kick the alumni in the teeth, because they don't need their money. Now, last Sunday afternoon, I had a visitor, a very wealthy man who is a Stanford graduate, and he told me that he had approached the Stanford trustees and offered to endow a chair in government. No control on the chair. The one stipulation was that he must take an oath of allegiance to the United States. This purpose in requiring that was he didn't want a Marxist or a revolutionist there. He wasn't even specifying a conservative. And they turned him down rather crudely and nastily. They didn't need his money. And if he wasn't just going to hand it to them and walk away, they didn't want to talk to him. They don't need it because they have federal funds. At the time that I made my study of the funds in Stanford in terms of writing something about it, and I did make a reference to this one point, even the Romance languages, Spanish and the like, were taught at Stanford with National Defense Fund. This is why when you're told how much money goes into national defense, remember, not much of it winds up in the hands of the military.
Questions beginning here are continued from tape two.
I can't laugh. It's so tragic. Accreditation today is a means of keeping good educators from doing their job.
I may say something too on this. I graduated from a little high school in a small farm community in the midst of the Depression, and they didn't even have the money to teach some of the courses that were required by the university. So when I applied at Berkeley, the University of California, I didn't have, I think, two of the necessary courses for college preparatory. And I recall that Dean Goldsworthy was just stepping out of a back office, and one of the clerks said, "Here's a student from high school who hasn't two of the courses and is applying." And he just asked, "What school?" And they said, "Kingsburg High School." And he said, "Let him in." And that was it. The reason I found out was that all the graduates of that school, though not accredited, had been A students. There were two of us who applied that year. We were both accepted. We both graduated with honors. Now, they had, I found, a record on every school. If a school, such as a new Christian school, didn't have one, they examined the first students. And then they built up a file on them. And they went by that rather than accreditation. So that although the farmers in our little community didn't have the money for a lot of courses and wouldn't hire the teachers, it didn't make any difference. They knew we were college material. Let them in. That was the attitude.
I would like to add this also in view of the article, that in my opinion, one of the worst laws that destroyed parental control over the child was compulsory education. And furthermore, here are persons who are appointing themselves as a ruling class to set up standards by which we are to be measured. And I was a high school dropout. Now, I'm not brilliant by any means. My IQ is maybe 78. But I just got tired of school, and as I said to some of you, and I don't mean this in a boasting way, but I just left at the 10th grade and went and applied to go to college and took the entrance exam and got in. And I went to 9 years of university after that and didn't have any trouble. We have a young man that graduated from the Christian Heritage School, and he received, without any accreditation, 2 unconditional scholarships from 2 different universities in the state of Alabama, left to his own choosing, where tuition and all was fully paid. Now, this young man was so outstanding that during his last year of high school, I had him to read through, in addition to his regular work in the high school, Rush Dooney's This Independent Republic, The American System, the politics of guilt and pity, and then at the age of 18, he ran for the presidency of the Alabama State Commission and made a good showing because he stood and was able to handle the issues from a Christian conservative perspective. And he made an impression, and people took him seriously, and I believe one day that in the realm of politics that he will be able to project the king rights of Jesus Christ and will come to some recognition. And he is a straight-A student in college at the present time. So these are frightening methods that are merely trying to make us surrender a little more of our own authority and freedoms to certain standards that are arbitrarily set up by these individuals. As Dr. Singer pointed out on the very painting of parking lines and such, you see. So I think that the harassment is a good sign. I think that we are finally being recognized. We're here. And let's keep it up. Let's agitate them to death. I believe in agitation. And let's just agitate them. By the way, I would highly recommend that anyone who wants to study the conspiracy from the Rush Dooney perspective, that they read very thoroughly and very closely and maybe several times the chapter devoted to it in his book, The American System, where he gives a tremendous exposition of Psalm 2, and is it in the Politics of Guilt and Pity or in the one in the many that you treat the Satanism and conspiracy?
I couldn't tell you.
Well, it's one or the other. Buy both and you'll find it. Anyway, it goes into quite some detail on this element of sovereignty that he dealt with, showing that if we deny the sovereignty of God, that we must get over into Satanism, and that we recognize that there is a controlling element in conspiracy outside of God's power and domain and control, that this is real witchcraft and demonism. But both books are worthwhile, and if you buy the one on the politics of guilt and pity, study over and over, from my perspective, maybe he'll want to rebut this, the chapter that deals with masochism and sadism, and if you understand his application of that, you'll start understanding a great deal that's happening not only in politics and courts, but in our schools and families as well. So that I want 10% of all the sales.
I have a question that perhaps applies to a couple of people. I might lay a little background for it, perhaps. First, I better spread some sugar. I certainly enjoy it. Being lectured by such an eminent talent. And I'm brand new practically in education, so I do have a lot of questions coming in my mind. Not long ago, I went through a college of education, so I may not be able to ask questions. It all didn't take, though, I don't think, so maybe I'm not quite.
That's good.
One thing I objected there to, in all of the readings we had to go through, it seemed to be that everything was all black or all white. Every author said public schools and education is going to come to a horrible end if we didn't immediately adopt their cure-all axiom of heaven. I think perhaps here we've painted things a little bit black and white. I wonder if perhaps there is not some middle ground. In other words, Reverend Ingham, can a teacher be certified by the state and also be a Christian or teach Christian? Can a school be accredited by the state and also offer quality education? To Dr. Rushing, you've been kept awful busy. I don't want to appear a defender of former movie actors from grade B lectures, but can a governor be interested in obtaining votes and also interested in Christian education? I think the question the gentleman there, Governor Reagan, does have, supposedly recognizes a conservative. He's done something, I think, admirable in trying to get some of the welfare workers put to work instead of just sitting on their high ends enjoying their gold. I've exposed a little of this, but I was fortunate enough to be stationed in California a couple of times. I was out there in my last duty station a couple of years ago. But this is something we are saying, I think, it's all black, it's all white, and it's only clean.
I think there is a black and white. I don't think that all things are either black or white. There's also gray, which is a mixture, and I have yet to encounter a human being that I was confident was totally consistent both in his convictions and his conduct. I suppose if we find, I'm just sort of thinking now, giving opinion, but I would think if I found a person who was a thoroughly consistent Christian in every corner and aspect of his life, that he must surely be already in heaven. And on the other side, it would be rash indeed to say that we do not have thousands upon thousands of good Christian people teaching in our government schools. I thought I said earlier that at one point that had it not been for this, that we would have been destroyed long since. And I think it's true today. On the other hand, I do not see how a school can be even reasonably called Christian if it accepts the governing control of an anti-Christian agency. This I cannot see. I mean, this I think is black and white.
Is the agency of necessity anti-Christian?
If it professes to be, yes, sir. Unlike Dr. Schwartz, he says you can trust the communists. You can trust them to be communists. And I think if a person devotes his life to fighting the implications of Christianity and the claims of Christianity, then I believe he's anti-Christian. And of all the areas in life where there is indeed certainly black and white, it is here. Somebody said earlier, I think it was perhaps Dr. Magruder, there's only one way to come to God. And there is only one way. And ultimately, in schools, I think this is what we're dealing with. Now, we may be very well-meaning and very well-intentioned, but there's still only one way. And this can be said about the Lord Jesus Christ. In fact, I think it must be said. I'm sure you've heard the line of reasoning of C.S. Lewis. Many others have said it, I know, but he made it popular. The Unitarian may say that he believes Jesus of Nazareth to have been a good man and a great teacher. He may say he is the best man that ever lived, the greatest teacher that ever lived. But if he says he was not God, then he has declared him to be the most hideous being that we can imagine, because he most certainly professed to be God. And he was either, or perhaps both, utterly wicked and stupid, or he is God. And there's no middle ground. And the same way with creation, which is involved in this school issue. There is no neutrality. You can make a statement, all things were made. And that statement is either true or false. But there cannot be any halfway. And if it's all true, then God. And if it's all false, then no God. And it's false if there's only one thing that wasn't made. So I wouldn't be afraid of black and white where it belongs.
I can understand your feelings with regard to Governor Reagan. Almost every time he opens his mouth, I'm delighted. Almost every time he acts, I'm horrified. Conservatives tend to be impressed by oratory and liberals by action. He satisfies both. The appointments he has made to the State Board of Education are, on the whole, worse than those made by his predecessor, Pat Brown, who was a very liberal Democrat. The appointments he has made to the parole board and various other boards that deal with law enforcement are worse than those of Pat Brown. He comes out very strongly against crime and against coddling offenders. But I spent the better part of a day with a friend who's a state senator in his office at the state capitol not too long ago. And he was showing me pictures of conditions in prisons. The newer ones look like country clubs. One of them has a golf course as well as tennis courts and swimming pool and so on. And he said that last year there were almost 9,000 escapees out of 17,000 prisoners. In the state prisons. The state prisons have a lower population than ever before in the state of California because under the policy of the administration, there are bonuses to the various counties and municipalities if they don't send them to the state prison. So there's a good record. We have less criminals. Now, there was a great deal of hue and cry because some of these escapees as well as parolees were out killing people. We're going to have far fewer escapees this year. You know why? Because the definition of an escapee has been changed. If he is caught within a certain amount of time and within, I believe, 3 miles of the prison, he's not an escapee. He's just AWOL. He's just strolling a little too far. Now, that's the kind of gymnastics that's going on. And it's too bad. Certainly, his expressed philosophy is excellent. One or two appointments he has made of his associates are good. But by and large, there's no great cause for joy in California, believe me. And certainly, in education and law enforcement, which are two key areas, we have lost ground badly.
Who does he listen to, you think, in those appointments? I mean, what pressures is he yielding to? Or?
I think he's playing politics. I think he is out to please everyone, and unfortunately, conservatives are very much impressed by oratory. The liberals want action. He satisfies both.
Same pattern in some sense applies to the president.
Yes, I think it's pretty much a national pattern. I believe that this is, on the whole, true of President Nixon as well. I think President Nixon is a much more intelligent man than Mr. Reagan. In fact, I believe perhaps the most brilliant mind we've had in the White House in this century is Mr. Nixon. I would not say he's the most moral mind.
I want to interject here about the certification. Dr. Singer spent, when did you lecture on the culture in this, the American educational scene?
Last night,
Dr. Singer traced the development of education in this country from the days of the colonies up to the present time. And I think established from historical data that the educational system today is very definitely humanistic. It is the school, or it is the church of the state. And it has been definitely established that the state religion is humanism, not Christianity. Now, it's my reflection, for whatever it's worth, that there are many good and fine Christian teachers who are certified. But if they are certified in order to teach, then they are receiving their authority and their permission to teach from a humanistic institution, either the state or the school board. And now to draw from another example, here's Dr. Magruder. He holds a master's degree from Yale and a master's degree from Columbia, and then he holds a doctorate from Louisville. Nevertheless, in the public school, he could not, with all those credentials, certified to teach the third grade, simply because he has not gone through the Dewey brainwashing of elementary educational philosophy, see. So he's not certified and could not be certified in this position. Now, if a person is certifying themselves in order to teach, if this is where they're getting their credentials, their permission, then they are being given the right to teach, the authority to teach, by the humanistic institution of state and education board. If they are certified teachers, but they are teaching in the context of Christian philosophy, not because of that certification, I don't see where they should apologize for the fact that they went ahead and got certified, but nevertheless, I don't see where they should seek to become certified if they're not, if they're going to teach in the context of Christian education. We don't require our teachers at Christian Heritage especially to be certified. I think it's foolish. I think it's a waste of time. Also, when you come to the accreditation of your school, all you're doing is asking the state permission to put their stamp of approval upon you through the Board of Education to allow you to exist as a school because your physical facilities may be measure up as to what they require. And there might be bedlam, there might be total ignorance, there might be totally inadequate subjects taught and inadequate students studying. But nevertheless, you will fly the banner of certification because the state says you have met certain qualifications that they've laid down. The same issue is involved here, and it's a black and white issue as to whether the church should ever pay taxes or not. Because the very day that the church pays taxes, it from that day on is recognizing its right to exist by permission of government rather than the kingship of Jesus Christ. And we recognize our right to exist and our right to teach and our right to carry forth our Christian culture from the king rights and our cultural mandate given by God the Almighty and from none other. And so it's black and white.
Dr. Singer, I'd like to ask you a question.
Yes, sir.
That is, several years ago, when Barry Goldwater was running for president, the editor and publisher of the Little Courier Journal, Barry Bingham, who is radically pro-communist,
I know that.
Put an editorial in which he said that Mr. Goldwater sees everything in black and white. He was referring to the fact that Goldwater was attacking communism very strongly. And he says, unfortunately, I can't share Mr. Goldwater's views because he said I see a murky gray in between.
He needs to go to an oculist.
Yes. What I'd like to say is, this idea of a gray person, I can't accept it. Perhaps on the human level, maybe some people can see a gray, but to me, on the divine plane, it's strictly black and white. I don't think God mixes truth and error.
I'm sure he doesn't. Is this your question?
Yes.
I gave a quote from James Orr the other night in which I said this, that he who believes with his whole heart that Jesus Christ is the Son of God commits himself to much else beside, to a view of God, to a view of man, to a view of sin, to a view of redemption, to a view of government, of history, and so on. And to this I commit myself. This is the essential standard. I know the general philosophical position of the Louisville Courier Journal. Pardon me? Yes. And it's by no means the only paper that takes that position. This is not to say I agree with everything that Barry Goldwater said and thought and did. He is a profane man. However,
so that's true. He is profane.
And it can be very crude, and I'm not defending.
I'm not standing up for Goldwater.
No. I didn't imply that you were. But I do think that when your issue on the issue of communism versus Christianity, it is black or white. When you're speaking on the issue of public education versus Christian education, it is black or white. It has to be. Recently, there came to my desk a part of a pamphlet published by the National Education Association, the last part of which I will quote to you. It is now obvious that the public school is the best agency to train young people in such matters as drug culture, exercise, physical education, and whatnot, and finally, to help them to live comfortably with the new emerging moral standards of the adult world, which is to say that the function of school is none else than to enable young people to live comfortably with the new morality, or more accurately, the new immorality, which is the old immorality with new vernacular dress to somewhat confuse an unsuspecting public. In other words, according to the NEA, the public school is to be the agency for the propagation of immorality. That, to me, is black.
Dr. Singer, yes. I ask you while you're on your feet, just a comment on this. It seems to me that with all the institutional betrayals of which we've spoken in the 20th century, and they're massive, betrayal of real ideas, as well as actions, law, that there's a remarkable survival and resilient, a residual respect for our Christian heritage, the American people generally, even though it may not, at least I hold this opinion, that despite what the churches have done to them, what the schools have done to them, what the politicians have done to them, they're still, most of the people in the polls want to be thought of on that side, where they can articulate the way I'm not. What I'm trying to say is this. With these institutional monolithic forces more or less frozen in, and we recognize they're not going anywhere, it's kind of a realm of death, it's not the main problem now of engineering, from our viewpoint, our representing, let's say, the crown rights of the Son of God, some way of bypassing these institutional obstacles so that
whatever residual concern there is among the people might have some channel of expression. It seems to me they're highly frustrated. There was no apparent release for what they do believe.
I find this out to be true.
Is that right?
Yes, it is. I am, because I did it 20 years or 25 years ago, I am licensed to preach by Concord Presbytery, the Presbyterian Church U.S. The one thing about the liberals, they will not preach in country churches if they can help it. They get sick on a Sunday morning at 9:33 a.m., and I get a frenzied call, our pulpit is vacant, will you please come for 11 o'clock service, which I always do. I have found out that in the Southern Presbyterian Church, our smaller, semi-rural, rural, and churches of small towns are almost uniformly hard, strong, conservative at the core. There's very little liberals among them. I'm always thankful of the irrelevancy of the General Assembly and the Presbyterian Church U.S. It is totally irrelevant to its own church, let alone the world. It has buried itself in its irrelevancy. And I am delighted because it has gone over the heads of the people, and they have talked in such existentialist tones that nobody understands them. And this is good. Their whole Sunday school literature program has gone bankrupt, and this is marvelous. They introduced a whole new vocabulary that nobody understood, and the churches gave it up. They couldn't handle it, which I encouraged them to do it, because I thought it was a fine way for them to go bankrupt, and they have. But I'm sure if you went to the Southern Baptist churches in the convention, you'll find that this is generally true. I am told, and you can tell me more, that this is also true in Northern Presbyterian Church.
It's disappearing in the major cities.
Yes, I'm sure that's true. But in the so-called projected union between Northern and Southern churches, there is the escape clause. The Northern Church is fighting it desperately, because if the Southern Presbyterian Church should go in, which we won't, we'll have a continuing church. But there is an escape clause. And it doesn't just mean the Southern Church is going to escape. It means that all churches are going to escape. And they're afraid there'll be an awful lot of escapees from the Presbyterian prison, the new church, if that time comes. The smaller churches, particularly in our Southern General Assembly, and I would assume in the Southern Baptist Convention, I was recently, believe it or not, asked to speak in a Methodist church in Salisbury. And I found there the laity, the men were very much interested in what I had to say. The pastor opposed me, but they pushed him aside almost literally and didn't listen to him. I may never get asked back, but I was there once. Does that answer your question?
Well, I'm concerned, yes, and that you take people here that have some hopes for the future, and Dr. Rushing pointed out, if their minds are just battered with various forms of satanic dark forces, you're just really, not you, but I mean, if we lend ourselves to that, then we're just enforcing what the enemy's already done to them. It's driving them deeper down, whereas they ought to be encouraged to believe that Christ has his hand on this country and that there's still hope for it.
Well, I agree to that.
And rebuild it.
How to do that is a great problem.
But how are you going to get the message out more effectively? That's what really the question.
Well, the Southern Presbyterian General, which I'm on the board, tries to do it. I preach the sovereignty of God to congregations.
And I know you're doing
that. Well, of course, I'm only one person, and I don't reach.
How can we do it now?
Christian schools.
My real belief is in the Christian school movement, because you get the young people. I'm not a prophet of doom. I'm very much aware of the problem. And I'm aware that, and I'm not really disagreeing with Dr. Rushing, I am aware that there are conspiracies in history. Now, you virtually admitted this in the conspiracy textbooks. There is a studied, if I might use the word conspiracy, to withhold the truth from American people in regard to American history. This is very widely known. I mean, they paint certain people's great heroes. Thomas Jefferson certainly was not. He had at least five illegitimate children, to my knowledge. How many more that I don't know about, I wouldn't say, obviously. Benjamin Franklin, likewise, was a thoroughgoing rascal. Benjamin Franklin stole his illegitimate son's wife. The man in question was William Temple Franklin, who was the royal governor of New Jersey at the time of the opening of the War for Independence. And I forget who it was, but I found this in a document. Someone asked him why he didn't join the Patriot cause, and he said, gave this classic reply to anybody, any cause which could win his father's loyalty was only worthy of his contempt.
The evidence now indicates that Benjamin Franklin, through the war, was an agent of the British Secret Service.
Well, he
This is through a man by the name of Edward Bancroft, who was an agent of the British Secret Service and Lord Shelburne. And Franklin found out about this, and so he didn't fire, he didn't do anything to Bancroft, he simply hired him and used him. And Shelburne used Bancroft, and so did Mr. Franklin used Bancroft. He also used a rabble-rouser in France who, among other things, wrote operas and also engaged in some other dubious enterprises on the side. He wrote the famous opera, The Marriage of Figaro, and The Barber Seville. Pierre, last name, well, he did. And Franklin was in tune with him and played ball with him. Franklin played ball with anybody with whom Franklin could make money. And he was a very, very unsavory character. There is evidence that Franklin, however, in the latter part of his life, did come back from this to a more Christian view. I have to say it in his defense. I'm not trying to besmirch man, but colonial history has been consistently misrepresented. And many great men in history have been misrepresented or totally overlooked. Men who are really evangelicals and who yet were men of tremendous stature, tremendous ability, and who have been given the short change every time. In this sense, there is a conspiracy among historians to belittle the true nature of American history. I would have to say that, although I also agree with Dr. Rushton, and this is not in disagreement with him. Pierre de Beaumarchais is the man who was a smuggler. He wrote the scores for operas. He was engaged in the smuggling business with Franklin, out of which he apparently made a great deal of money, and Franklin knew all about it, and was a disreputable Frenchman.
I'm just asking you about, and I appreciate if you would like to make any comment on the role and influence of John Witherspoon as an example. It was pointed out recently in Christianity Today of a man who retained his Christian calling and at the same time tried to render some service to the Continental Congress and the Declaration.
Yes, John Witherspoon sometimes gets a passing sentence in history textbooks that he was a Presbyterian minister who was president of the College of New Jersey. And that ends it, because to say more, of course, would be embarrassing. He was an evangelical Christian. He was a strong Calvinist. He was a tremendously well-educated man. And he'd had some problems with George II in England. And he came to this country. And fighting England was no great problem to him. He'd been doing it all his life. And he simply transferred the scene of activity and kept going. But he tried to hold the Continental Congress on an evangelical keel. There were strong evangelicals in the Continental Congress, and you'd never guess who they were, and they never said much about it. Well, they did, but the history books don't. One of them was Elias Boudinot, a French Huguenot of tremendous persuasion. Another was Roger Sherman, who said of himself he was the ugliest man in Congress. If you see his picture in Washington up there with the Declaration of Independence signers, you will have to agree with him on that point. But he was also a tremendous evangelical, a man of tremendous and stalwart opinion, who had an evangelical, we would say today, Episcopalian, William Samuel Johnson, who later became president of King's College, now Columbia University, but who was a delegate from Connecticut at the time. These men were strong and great men, but you'd never guess it. William Samuel Johnson happened to be a member of the Scientific Society in London, highly honored in England for his scientific and scholarly works.
George Mason.
George Mason, likewise. One of Patrick Henry's fellow members of Congress called Patrick Henry, "Ye very saint in religion and ye very devil in politics." Speaking, he was a Tory. He said, "Patrick Henry, was ye very saint in religion, but ye very devil in politics." Because of his tremendous oratorical ability, he created trouble wherever he spoke. But his life, his character was unimpeachable. And Calvinistic, that's what I, yeah, sure. Patrick Henry. Any other questions? Did I answer your question? Do I pass that one?
Dr. Singer is an example of that twisting of history
These Tennesseans ought to be interested enough, making reference to Dr. Rushdoony's American system again, his defense of Andrew Johnson in there defending him from the false charges that were brought against this man. And the Tennesseans ought to read that come to this man's defense.
Andrew Johnson is probably one of the most maligned, openly maligned men in American history. He was a man of tremendous ability. There's probably no man who ever occupied the presidential chair who knew more about the Constitution than Andrew Johnson. His message to Congress in his tenure of office are the most majestic statements of constitutional doctrine known in our political history from presidents, with the possible exception of John Quincy Adams. Johnson was to a great extent self-taught. He was a stalwart Presbyterian. He was a man of tremendous physical ability, a tremendous physical courage. In 1856, when he was running for the senatorial office here, up here at Jonesboro, right near where my wife's from, near Johnson City, there was a plot to assassinate him when he ascended the rostrum. And he was told about it. And so the night he went to speak at the courthouse in Jonesboro, he said, "Just by the way, ladies and gentlemen, I understand that there are two men here who are going to shoot me here tonight." And he said, "Would you mind standing up?" Now, Andrew Johnson was a dead shot. He was better than Andrew Jackson. And nobody stood up to test out Andrew Johnson. Nobody stood up. But he was a man of tremendous physical courage.
What's your assessment on Abraham Lincoln?
A very equivocal character. Abraham Lincoln, until Franklin Roosevelt, broke more important clauses of the Constitution under the guise of expedience than any other president we've ever had until Franklin Roosevelt. He illegally enlarged the army. He illegally enlarged the navy. He illegally promoted men to generalships. He illegally moved money from one part of the federal expense budget to another. He closed churches. He took men out of the pulpit. He sequestered the railroads and he sequestered the telegraph lines. He blockaded southern ports. He illegally issued the Proclamation of Emancipation. He withdrew the writ of habeas corpus. And he claimed that these are all unimportant clauses of the Constitution in order to save the whole. To which J.G. Randall pointed out that if he kept going, there would have been no hole left to save.
If Johnson's plans had been carried through without that villain, the Stevens you were speaking of last evening, he would have restored dignity to this republic.
Indeed, Johnson's plans were carried out. Not many people realize this, but even Texas was finally restored under the Johnson plan. But when these men came back to take their seats in Congress, Stevens, Wade, Sumner, Butler, and the rest refused to allow them to have their seats. But I don't know whether you know this or not. In 1870, Andrew Johnson, having been impeached but found innocent, was elected to the Senate of the United States by the Tennessee legislature. And one of the most impressive and exhilarating moments in Senate history came when he appeared at the door to take his seat in the Senate. The sergeant of arms of the Senate said, Mr. President, I have the honor to introduce as a new senator, the Honorable Andrew Johnson from Tennessee. The whole Senate arose, and he was escorted right down front where he'd been in his old seat before the war. Did you know that?
We have any further questions? We're running late, but there are...
Authorized by the Chalcedon Foundation. Archived by the Mount Olive Tape Library. Digitized by ChristRules.com.